We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain sensing headband that helps you meditate and sleep, and Meditation Studio, the 5-star app. I'm Patricia Karpus. Today's guest is Richard Hawks, thought leader, change expert, and founder and CEO of Growth River, an international consulting firm. He's the author of the book Navigate the Swirl, 7 Conversations for Business Transformation. He specializes in helping organizations and individuals scale and grow. In fact, he was my executive coach over 15 years ago, and a big reason I made some pretty important changes in my life at that time. What I liked about this discussion was all of the connections I started thinking about between business transformation and personal transformation. They both involve activating purpose, driving focus, shifting mindset, aligning strategy, and implementing initiatives, right? When we discussed the kind of team you need to build a high-performing organization, I wondered about the teams we build as individuals, those in our tribe, so to speak, that support and encourage our own transformation. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Now, on to Richard. Richard, welcome to Untangle. I'm so thrilled to have you with us today.
I am so happy to be here.
I want to start by, I usually ask what inspired you to write this book, but I want to know a little bit more about you and your background and what led you to the inspiration for this book.
The book is ultimately about, when you're working with other people in a team, how do you unblock all the things that are in the way of achieving more together? And so I think your question really is, so what in my background has made that an area of passion for me? And I grew up in Princeton, New Jersey. My mother is an Episcopal priest. She was the first woman ordained in New Jersey. And my father was an orthopedic surgeon, and he was also head of Princeton Medical Center. So I grew up in a family where I saw the kind of topics, how do you bring people together and how do you accomplish something beyond yourself in it together? That was the dinner table conversation. So I think I probably was set up from the beginning for that to be something that I was directed towards.
And then what inspired you to actually write this book? And when did you start your work as a business coach, as someone that was helping to unblock organizations so that they could be more high performing?
I started doing the work about 30 years ago, which is mind blowing to me. I started actually right when I was in business school. I started doing it almost immediately because I was really enjoying what I was learning, and I was going out immediately to try to work with teams and organizations to apply everything that I was learning. The ideas for the book formed over those 30 years with literally hundreds of teams and organizations all around the world. And then they gelled, and then it took about 2 years to write the book.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like the wisdom of the book has been an amalgamation of a family that inspired you to want to do good in the world and your work as a business coach and your studies. So it all came together. And you have this premise in the book that businesses are social systems with many individuals. I'm curious, and we all know how complex individuals are, how complex we each are. What are some of the dynamics inside of organizations that lead to the stagnation that you're talking about? What's happening? Why do we need to unblock the things that are in our way?
So it's interesting. I think, first of all, is there are a lot of people whose job it is to unblock. In other words, they're not going to be successful in their careers and in their lives unless they know how to do this. And I think human beings, what makes us remarkable is not that we can follow orders. What makes us remarkable is that we can come together and align around a vision or a set of objectives, and in parallel, creatively innovate really remarkable things together in relationship with you. That's just exciting. And so when I'm unblocking is that. Unblocking is you and I are just human beings. We're looking out from our perspective through conversations like this to hopefully sending them out into the world and having an impact. As you lean into that, that really fundamental question about how do we have an impact through each other, through these groups, to something larger? And what does that even mean? Brings you to that. Now, there's this social systems idea that you just pointed to. And the thing is, one of the things that keeps people from even being able to imagine what I just said is they think about the world, they think about other people, they think about teams, organizations, as if they're machines. And as if people are just cogs in those machines. And people don't like that much. When someone else thinks of you as a cog in a machine and you start to act like one, it really shuts down what is possible. So the idea of a social system, and even just thinking about what that means, is kind of like a doorway into an entirely different way of thinking about how do you unblock businesses to create competitive advantage, organizations to grow and scale. Yeah, and frankly, just how to live life in a more fulfilling, exciting, fun way.
Yeah, and in the foreword, Penny talks about the importance of a shared purpose. And she's someone that's been through your programs. Her business has been through your programs. And it made me think of so many companies have mission statements. Maybe they put them up on an internal website and then they move on. And you talk about an ongoing intention setting and reflection process. And I'm curious, what is this process? I mean, how do you work with people to align on purpose and then daily or weekly or monthly have this intention and reflect on how it's going?
I think you've run to the heart of things. It's a journey. So the thing about a purpose is that it's a destination that you actually never reach. It's not like you're 100% there. There's always a gap or lots of gaps between the current state and this ideal future state. So people often have an ambiguous relationship with this idea of an ideal going towards whatever this ideal is. And frankly, I think often it's because whenever you talk about ideals, maybe it's in our school systems, maybe it's, I don't know what, but people's experience is being made wrong. They have this aversion to conversations around purpose, mission, vision, all this stuff, and a healthy cynicism about it. But many people's experience around this is not a comfortable one, or one where they come not enjoying that. But what happens is that when you really zero in with a team or an organization on, let's get very, very clear about where are we headed together? What are we journeying towards? What are the gaps in the current state between where we are and that ideal state? What do we need to do next in very practical terms? What are our priorities? And then the fourth question is really, what are the breakthroughs that we need to create? In other words, what are the things we need to innovate or lean into? If a team can answer those four questions, if an organization can answer those four questions, then they're on a journey together. If they're missing any of those four anchor points, it's likely that they're going to get caught up in this swirl where there's always another problem, always another drama, but where are we going? With Penny's organization, or frankly, it's the same four anchor points, whether you're talking about your own life and where you're headed, or whether you're in a team, or whether you're in an organization, or whether you're in a business. The architecture of being on a journey towards a purpose or an ideal future state is pretty much the same. And you're pretty much always touching on those four dimensions.
And I was wondering, because you say in the beginning of the book that your personal objective is to plant the seeds for a shared language that helps people work together in a deeply human way. And I had two questions that are very different. One's about work, but I'll ask the personal one first. How do we do this in our important relationships? And all of our good relationships are important, but in our personal relationships with our spouse, our partners, our children, how do we find a shared language that helps us to be together in a deeply human way?
Wow. So we can only see the things together that we really have a shared language for. And that's how you and I are using all of these words, and I'm packaging up my thoughts into words and then sending them over this to you, and you're unpackaging them, and hopefully it's being communicated. So we can only move in our relationships with each other, in our alignment with each other, even with our alignment with ourselves, at the speed of the language available to us. Now, what's pretty amazing about language, though, is you don't actually have to have exactly the right words. You just have to have an intention to find the right words. So if you've ever traveled and you didn't speak a language, it's amazing what you can do by just with your hands and feet. Let's point to that thing. And what happens is, before you know it, is you're co-creating language with the person next to you. And co-creating language, the intention to co-create, to truly understand another person, to truly be in it with them, is language creation. That's what sets us apart. My answer to that question, it's a really deep question. I think it all begins with just the intention to actually communicate, and to communicate in a precise, thoughtful, positive, possibility creating way with another human being. I think you just end up creating language.
Yeah. A word from our sponsor, Happy Mammoth. This is the company that created the amazing supplement Hormone Harmony, and they are dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients like herbal extracts called adaptogens that help the body adapt to any stressors, especially those chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. They're offering our listeners 15% off the first order at happymammoth.com using the promo code UNTANGLE. So if you're tired of hot flashes, night sweats, low moods, poor sleep, you get the drill. The things that put your life on hold, you will want to check them out. For a limited time, you can get 15% off on your entire first order at happymammoth.com with the code UNTANGLE at checkout. That's happymammoth.com with the code UNTANGLE. Now, on to UNTANGLE. I like the way you answered that one. The second part of the question is more from an organizational standpoint, and I was curious about training. You talk about this in the book, training IQ and EQ, emotional intelligence, and your intelligent quotient. How do you create high-performing individuals, or is it partially helping teams learn how to hire the right people who are open and available for learning this process?
It's an end, end, and end. So I think the first thing is, within organizations and within businesses in particular, people don't have a lot of patience for working it all out. They want to accelerate the entire thing. So the book includes a distillation of thousands of conversations across hundreds of teams down to this core set of conversations that, if you intentionally engage in them, that it'll radically accelerate how you come together as a team to grow and scale your business. in that context. And that's what the book includes.
We're going to go through those seven crucial conversations in a little bit.
So we'll get to that. But your question really has to do with, okay, so first of all, can I hire people for this? Yes, you can. In fact, what high-performing organizations tend to do is first hire people for their ability to have their EQ, their ability to have effective relationships, work relationships first, and then for their technical skills second. And leaders who do the opposite, you get a short-term burst, but then when you try to grow and scale a company, you often find yourself with a toxic work environment, all sorts of things going on because you didn't prioritize that. And the thing that's amazing is the people who have the EQ skills tend to be way faster at learning anyway and way better at working together. So even if they don't have the technical skills, they tend to learn them much, much faster than the people. So it tends to be a win-win. The second point is I've met a lot of leaders who dream of replacing their entire team or their organization, and almost none who've ever been able to do that. You come in and you have to work with what you have, which means it isn't about swapping people out. It's about developing people and developing your organization. And when you realize that the only way forward is through that, through those other folks, suddenly this conversation, this question about the right blend of EQ and IQ becomes incredibly important because it's the only way you're going to be successful. So the heart of leadership and the many leaders who I've worked with, they don't live in a world where there's almost even a distinction between strategy and people or culture. They're just trying to get stuff done, and they need the right people with the right mindsets in the right roles with the right technical skills. They need all of it. It seems to be that the service providers want to somehow divide this up, but for the actual people doing it, it's kind of one thing. I mean, you've led teams, you know that. I assume that's been your experience.
Absolutely. And I'm also wondering, so we talk about the right hiring or working with what we've got within the organizations. What is the actual process for taking people from looking at the organization as a machine to thinking of it as a social system? Like, how does that transformation actually happen?
You know, like when you learn anything, it's a theory and then you have experience that validates it. And then suddenly it's just is the way the world works because you now see it. It's that process. You start with a leader and team and organization, and you introduce this idea that it really is a social system, not a machine. And then you start to apply that idea. And then you check it against the reality. And what tends to happen is the experiences on these transformational journeys to develop teams and then to have those teams transform organizations or systems of teams to come together to build high-performing organizations. This way of thinking just gets really reinforced. And then it actually becomes part of the culture and just becomes the way in which teams operate. But it's very akin to learning a language. At first, you're just trying to order things and pay the bill at the restaurant. But eventually, it's quite amazing because it's the world in which people live. These words and these concepts quickly just become part of how a team or an organization operates, and everyone starts speaking it fluently.
In the book, you have an example of a small business actually called Radiant Love. It's a love cafe. I thought it was a really fun idea. And this business, each time it got to a particular juncture, needed to make some changes. I would love for you to share the example of the four stages of evolution, but as it relates to this love cafe, how and when does an organization know it's time to change? And maybe as a part of that example, you can answer that. Is that too hard?
Yeah, I'll answer that right up front and then I'll do the piece. There's knowing that you need to change and there's the world conspiring to give you no choice.
Right.
Often we realize after the world has conspired to give us no choice that we need to change. And sometimes we're just summarizing the things that are, these are just processes that are unfolding. And so the four evolutionary stages were literally created by tracking hundreds of teams through their entire life cycle or various parts of it, like mapping DNA, lots of little fragments being pulled together, to really reveal this universal journey that every business goes on and the logic behind it as a social system. Basically, how does a business change as it grows and scales? And then what does that require from leaders in terms of what they need to bring to it, and then teams and so on. And so the Radiant Love Cafe example, we created it as a composite. And the reason we chose that is because the center of this is this story of this woman who's a matchmaker and her grandson, and they build a business. And the thing is, for her, this idea of love, introducing people as a matchmaker, is this really sacred, extraordinary vision. But you can also imagine all the things that could pull that sideways. The last thing she wants is to turn into Tinder, for example. And so that storyline appealed to me and then to my team, because there's so much that could be misunderstood or could go wrong about it. Just could go really wrong on the journey. So anyway, the journey is, it takes you through the four stages. And the first stage that pretty much every business starts in is what we call the independent contributor stage. And that's where you have this loose confederation of people working together. And it's not really a business yet. It's more like a lot of fluidly changing alliances. And the feeling, if you're leading a business like that, and I've built businesses myself where I've been at that stage, but I've also worked with quite a number of leaders who've been at that stage. It's like you're in the middle of the ocean and you're treading water and you're alone. And along comes a piece of driftwood and you grab it, and along comes another piece of driftwood and you grab that, and then maybe a piece of fishing line, and you strap it all together and you build a raft, and you stand up on the raft and someone comes along and tells you that you built it all wrong. What I mean by that is you cut deals with anybody to build your business. It's all these very personal relationships that are really all complicated and messy and connected. And usually what happens is that you have your business and it's working. And that's the example with Radiant Love. They start a cafe, and the cafe is a matchmaking cafe, and it ends up being very, very successful. But it's this community of people around it. There's the guy making the croissants and the person at the cappuccino machine, and then the musicians who come in. It's just a very loose thing. And what happens in most organizations that bring them from this first stage into the second stage is some event happens where it's really, really clear that you need to have a single leader and a single business strategy, that having everybody work in parallel is just not going to get it done. It's not scalable. And so usually what happens is then a leader will step up and say, okay, I'm going to be the business leader. And they have to renegotiate often all these relationships that they've created around them, which they have to realign all of those things and present a vision forward, and also provide an opportunity for many of the people who've been with them to choose in or choose out. Many leaders I've worked with have a lot of sadness around that stage, because they've had to now start building a business for real and nail and scale a business model. And that's required them to maybe renegotiate a lot of these lifestyle choices, often with people they really care about. And that's that second stage. And the second stage is called directive leadership. And the idea is that you have a single business model and everything is focused on nailing and scaling that. And this is the stage that most like Silicon Valley startups are in. This is the stage where you can bring in investment if you want, but it's about how quickly can we really laser focus on a single business model and scale it. And then what happens is an organization runs into another level where a single business model is no longer cutting it. So what happens is they start getting bigger and they start to discover their different markets, their different customers, their different business segments. And they have to respond to that, because if they don't, they're not going to be able to continue growing and scaling, and their competition is going to actually tear them apart by pulling their customers away and serving different customer segments in more effective ways. And that inflection point takes you into an organization with multiple businesses and multiple functions serving those businesses. And that's a massive cultural change, because now you're a matrix. And so the analogy is akin to, in that second stage, directive leadership, it's like moving the chess pieces. In the third stage, which is called distributed leadership, it's like creating the conditions for the chess pieces to move themselves. That requires a very different level of sophistication. When you go to distributed leadership, you have to move into a leader-led team-based, business-focused organization. And that's where this whole idea of high-performing teams comes along. And this is where you're able to bring people together in teams to play, and those teams play various roles in an organization to divide up the complexity so everybody owns a different domain and have the whole system work together in a purposeful way. And so that's really the third stage. And in the example of the Radiant Love Cafe, they go through the second stage, the founder, matchmaker, she passes away, her grandson grows and scales the organization, they open up cafes all over the country. And now suddenly they find that they need to begin offering a digital app. They need to start to get into very different business models. And they're now moving into this third stage, distributed leadership. And it's about how that change happens. In the storyline, he actually realizes he is not really able to lead this next stage, that that's not really his thing. He was fine. And he brings in a new leader to run the distributed leadership stage. And that's not uncommon. In fact, I'd say that's happens more often than not. And then the fourth stage, which in the book, we don't really take the Radiant Love Cafe to that place, but is leaders leading leaders. And this is what happens when the capability to create and sustain high-performing teams in an organization is really reached a maturity level where it's built into the organization. You have all the functional capabilities around these big functions like HR and training, development, and coaching, like all that internal consulting capacity and that kind of stuff. Then you're able to sustain self-managing teams, and you're able to very quickly, whenever you want to pursue an opportunity, spin up a team to do that. You have an organization that is able to create and launch and manage a portfolio of all different kinds of teams. And that's that fourth stage. The book really takes you through everything you need to know to not only recognize where you are in those stages, but what are the distinctions you need to know, the ideas you need to understand, the ways of talking that you need to understand to navigate right through all four of those stages.
Yeah, this show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. We talk about these often on Untangle. When we keep things bottled up inside, it can start to impact our health mentally, emotionally, and physically. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, whatever it is. If this sounds like you, and it's a bit of all of us, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule and needs. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now over to Untangle.
It's interesting to me because in the example of Radiant Love, the cafe, the founder, the grandmother had set up, I think, something like 100 couples. So for her, it was like a act of joy versus a business. And then her grandson was like, hey, let's create this cafe. And she loved it. And then she dies. And this goes on a different journey. It starts expanding throughout the country. I would imagine that at each stage, and I think this is true in life as well, you're making a choice. Do you want to move through those stages or do you not? It's like in any business. Some people want to go along that journey, and then some people would just like a simple lifestyle business that they can wake up, go to, do whatever it is that gives them the most joy.
I think you're pressing on two points, and I absolutely agree. One is that in the example, as the business grew in scale, there's a real concern that this beautiful thing, that service, I don't know, gift that the grandmother is providing to people could get lost, that the essence could get lost as it turns into fast food of matchmaking. How do you distill out these most important parts into something that's scalable in an organization is a key theme. That's really hard to do. It requires a lot of intentionality. I've seen it done really, really well in organizations like when I work with Johnson & Johnson, for example, J&J and their Credo and some of these things. I've seen it done really, really well, and I've seen the magic get lost. What I can say is that if it's a team-based organization where the teams themselves are very purpose-driven. And that means customer-focused. They're really bought into this. It's possible. It is possible. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that if you're a business owner and you built a business because it needs to be the right scale for you, it is an extension of you. It's an extension of you in the world. That's a really beautiful thing, but you have to be careful about your choices, because if you bring in investment, it's no longer an extension.
Yes, absolutely.
It's now a larger social system that isn't in service of you anymore. It's in service of fill in the blank, whatever the purpose is of the organization. And that's often really hard for people to navigate.
That's an excellent point. What is your thought on a company like Twitter with a new leader and mass exodus based on the leader's choice, basically, and new rules, new guidelines? The business is basically going to change in numerous ways. In order for an organization to change, everyone has to be aligned, and this is clearly not that. But how would you look at this situation?
Okay, so the first thing to recognize is I think Elon Musk is following the VC playbook. There's this very clear blueprint that it's very prevalent in Silicon Valley, and it's this playbook. And the playbook basically says, we're going to really refocus on growing and scaling. And what we're going to do is we're going to emphasize just a few set of core capabilities. That's going to be market messaging. It's going to be sales. It's going to be hiring, technical hiring. And it might include, depending on the business, some regulatory compliance stuff. And everything else is not important. Now, that requires, though, that you have a very clear single business model that you're going to nail and scale. And it also, there's a whole cultural thing about this. It requires a workforce that is willing to sleep underneath their desks and have pizza slid underneath the door and all this. So there's an entire cultural attribute of this. That's the blueprint that he's following. I wouldn't bet against him because I think that he's going to focus in on that and really try to focus in on innovating this platform as much as he can. The fact is, though, is the social contract. And so what I see around Twitter is the entire conversation around the social contract is different. You've heard about the educational cliff that's coming up, you know, that expression?
Yes.
So something like, supposed to be like a 15% drop in college kids. So they're saying that an awful lot of small colleges in particular are going to just go out of business in the next 5-7 years. So I have 3 daughters who are in their 20s, and when I talk to them, they look at the tech bro culture and they look at the deal that's been offered. And their friends have all gone and worked for these tech. And they're like, it's not a very good deal. Most people, they work like crazy and they give their lives for these organizations, these tech startups. And frankly, only a few people do well and everyone else is dealt out by the system. And so they're just completely cynical about that model. So what happens to something like Twitter? If you build a model like that, that depends on these young folks, and none of them are going to be available in 5 years because they've opted out. So I don't think his playbook is wrong, but I do think the demographics of this have him set up potentially to hit a wall. And I think most of the criticisms people are making are he's letting these people go and he's doing this because the social contract has really changed during COVID. And we all look at Twitter and we're kind of like, free speech needs to be fill in the blank. What does that need to feel like? A platform for free speech. We don't want free speech to be an aggressive, assertive, only business focused. That's not what people are looking for when they imagine a functioning democracy. So it's really interesting. He's saying, I want to build a platform for a functioning democracy. My vision for it is a bunch of young guys sleeping underneath their desks. And people are like,
they're like, I don't want to sleep there.
No, most of us have families, kids, lives that we're living. Like, so I think there's a big disconnect.
Well, it'll be interesting. It'll be an interesting journey to see what actually happens. I want to shift back to your book for a second. You have the 7 crucial conversations, and we've talked a little bit in and around them, but I'd love for you to go through each of them and maybe start with activating purpose and just talk about each one.
So the 7 crucial conversations is really a roadmap for what are the conversations, if you're the leader of a team, a business team, an enterprise team, a functional team, and you really want to align your team to become a high performing team, that means they're highly intentional, they're highly focused. There's an experience of trust that they're having with each other and they're having fun. If you want to get to that place, what's the map to get there? And how do you plan it out? And how do you organize it? How do you know where you are? And how do you get there as efficiently as possible? And that's what the seven crucial conversations are a map for. The first three have to do with leadership and culture. So that the first one is activate purpose. The second one is driving focus. And the third one is shifting mindset. And those three conversations are really in this domain of leadership and culture within a team and then across an organization. The second two have to do with capabilities and roles. So that they're specifying capabilities and roles, and they're streamlining interdependencies. So this is all about within a team, you have a system of roles, and within an organization, you have a system of teams. And it's all about, okay, great. How do I get that system to adjust and align on a developmental journey so you can scale, so you can work out problems, so you can clean stuff up, so you can work across silos, all of that. And then the last two conversations, it's aligning strategies and implementing initiatives. And this is, all right, so in most organizations, people think about a business strategy, but there's actually a lot of different kinds of strategies. There's enterprise strategy and business strategy and various functional strategies, developing strategies and selling strategy, and developing products and services and selling them and delivering them. So if everybody's coming with their own strategy, how do you align all that so you're really in it together? And then in that context, how do you actually implement? So that's the flow. What's really important to know is that there's a directionality to this. And when people go against the directionality, that's where organizations tend to fail, like significantly. These are the epic fails. A lot of people want to just jump to strategy and implementation. And that's a mechanistic worldview. Like, I'm going to just do the strategy and I tell people what to do and they're going to execute. But as you start trying to execute, you quickly discover, well, what's in my way? What tends to be in your way? Or roles aren't clear, or they're not divided up in a way that they actually work. And certain capabilities are missing. And as you start to lean into, wow, well, let's add roles or let's renegotiate capabilities, you discover you just can't go there because people go into survival mode and they start fighting with each other. War breaks out because you're trying to divide up power and the power conversation. And you find that you've got to go into the leadership and culture conversation. So the trick to any major change journey, whether it's a merger, an acquisition, a growing and scaling a company, entering a new product, is to go in the order of the conversations, to start with leadership and culture and get the baseline norms and ways of working so that you can then navigate the conversation around capabilities and roles, which is the boneyard for most major initiatives. And then you work your way into reframing your whatever your strategies are and implementing. Then you're able to actually distribute leadership for it all. It's a roadmap to keep teams and organizations from hitting a wall when they try to drive change.
Yeah, and it sounds like the flow has a lot to do with laying the foundation for the intentions and business that you're creating. And how do you measure success? Do you have KPIs? When you implement these conversations, how are you able to tell if it's been successful or not? Does the organization look much different?
It tends to feel very different because you're in a high-performing team. The conversation moves really rapidly to solving whatever the constraints are. And the constraint could be in mindset. The constraint could be in your roles. The constraint could be in your strategy. It could be in implementation. But as teams get good at this, they tend to really accelerate. And the experience of somebody stepping into one of these organizations is they're often just blown away. The decisions that get made before breakfast by these teams, they're huge decisions. Then they just take them and they're done and they're aligned. And in other companies, they take weeks, months, or even years for people to align around. So the experience is a radically accelerated experience. The way that people look at things is, of course, you have KPIs and metrics because there are always stakeholders who demand those and need them. And everybody needs to know you're creating practical outcomes. But what's different is you could have great metrics and run your business, your organization right off a cliff because they're the wrong ones, because they are taking you on the wrong journey in the wrong direction. What really changes is leaders and teams start to assess where they're going against their destination, this back to where we started to. And they're able to recognize when breakthroughs are happening on that journey. So what happens is that transformational journeys are made up of event horizons. An event horizon would be a moment in time where everything shifted, everything shifts. And the thing about event horizons is before an event horizon, you can't predict how the world's going to work after an event horizon. So let's say I'm on a team or on an organization, you're going to bring in a new leader. We can all guess what it's going to be like after the new leader arrives, but we don't really have any idea until the new leader is actually there doing their thing. And once the new leader arrives or the new product's been created or whatever the event horizon is, there's a big shift. So before an event horizon, it's all about staying focused to create the conditions for the event horizon and not going off into worrying or hypothesizing about everything could go wrong or all of that. It's a very different leadership challenge. After an event horizon, the leadership challenge is how fast can we learn how the world now works? So when an event horizon occurs, there's something that happens in a high-performing organization, which is everybody recognizes that it's actually occurred. They're not relitigating the past. It's this shift has changed. This has happened. We don't know exactly what it means yet. All hands on deck to figure it out. So leaders and teams start to judge progress based on event horizons. They have this kind of meta view of I'm on a journey and look. And when you ask them, they tell you a story about the past, which is like an epic story. This happened, and then we learned this, and then this happened, and we learned. But they're all telling you the same story because they have a perspective on the journey.
Yeah. I'm going to switch gears again before we close and have two more questions for you. And the first one is, what are some of the biggest lessons that you've learned about human nature from the work that you've done over the last 30 years through life coaching and business coaching and all of it?
When people aren't invited into the conversation, whatever the conversation is, the conversation about where an organization is headed, a team is headed, about their own lives, their own careers, they're really faced with a choice, which is either typically either to check out or to resist.
Yeah. So engagement.
Yeah. Well, engagement and power and alignment and all of that. And pretty much all of my regrets in working in these change journeys have to do with not having had time usually or to really bring people into the conversation early enough and when there was the opportunity. And sometimes water goes under the bridge and it's just past the point where people are willing. And these are good people. So there are certain moments in time that are actually more important than others. And there's certain conversations at moments in time that are really essential. And if you miss them, the consequences follow you.
Well, I think that's true in our personal relationships as well as our business relationships.
I think that's right. But there's one other thing, which is kind of amazing. And I know that a lot of your audience are meditators. I'll just say that taking time to slow down and just listen and contemplate, and then to authentically engage with people and say, look, I missed this opportunity. I missed that. Can we reframe our relationship? Can we reframe the conversation? What can we do? You can recover from an awful lot if you come to it with the right ways of being.
I'm glad you brought that up because my second question was going to be, what is your personal meditation practice and how do you integrate that into your life?
Yeah, I meditate pretty much every day. I prefer to meditate for do some yoga, then meditate and then do some more yoga. So it's about an hour and a half I'm able to do typically 4 days a week. And then on weekends, I'll sometimes take longer because I just really, really enjoy it. So my meditation practice is I focus very much on getting myself into a mindful state. And then when I'm there, I have various practices that I follow. Many of them are Buddhist practices. So things like loving kindness meditation or various practices. And it really depends on what's going on with me. I pick up the tool that's going to help me get closer to that state.
That's so great. And I'm sure that's helped you so much in your sometimes chaotic work life and travel schedule. Thank you for being with us today. I loved your book, and I'll leave people with where they can pick it up in our outro. But I'm so grateful to have you with us today.
You're very welcome. Absolute pleasure. And thank you for giving me an opportunity to just talk about what. Well, I'm pretty passionate about this.
Thanks for being with us today. Richard's book is available on Amazon and all major booksellers. Check out Muse at choosemuse.com when you have a minute. And as always, use discount code UNTANGLE15. We also appreciate all the amazing reviews you've shared. They help us to grow. So thank you. Any comments or guest suggestions, please send them our way at untangle@choosemuse.com. Hope you have a great week, and we will see you next time.